Accession number 28776, Reel 15.
I go Reel 15.
Where did you get to? Do you remember on that one? How far had I got?
You just on?
Had we finished the story about Terence Shaw?
Well, you just explained the story, yeah. And you were just saying, yeah. It just goes to show.
Yes, that's right. Well, anyway, that was in part. Of course, it was. We were still. Although I'd said the organisation of the squadrons was much better. I mean, there was still a lot of. Well, I don't know whether you call it. Enjoyment or not, but a lot of drinking went on. I mean, I was never drank very much, if anything at all. And I knew that my director, who used to go for Silver Cross, which was just across the way from the old Admiral building, to have his lunch, and would have a very liquid lunch. And therefore, I very quickly learned that trying to get anything done in the afternoon was a waste of time. So I used to get anything I had to get done. This was a chap called... David Kirk, who was very kind to me over the years, and I went to his funeral, funnily enough, some months back. But the DNAW, the lads in DNAW, and they had like three directors, who were all captains in this space, the director, the deputy director, and the assistant director of that. And the lads very quickly locked on to the fact the way to get a long liquid lunch was to say, well, he's gone to a meeting. And they used to go to, there was a drinking place just off Trafalgar Square by Nurse Cavell's monument there, just there somewhere, down in the basement. I never went there, but there was a drinking club there. And it was like the Devil's Hole, or shall we say, or something. I can't remember. And so their great cry was, oh, yes, sir, he's gone for a meeting in DHOV, you see, which was the Devil's Hole. And for months they got away with this, and they were all down there boozing. But it was, I was always a bit stuffy on those kind of occasions, I suppose, but a lot of them had a very enjoyable time, I'm sure. But that was a difficult period when we were trying to fit... the Navy, the size of the Navy we wanted, and it was then 90,000, I think, was the frontline strength, into the money that was available. With new aircraft coming along and all the various problems that that produced. But, and of course, we had in service then Victorious with 984 CDS, that's a comprehensive display system. Which were completely brand new, and Hermes the same, and Eagle the same. and they were miles ahead of anything the Americans had at that time, miles ahead. But, as is always the case in these things, you never get very much credit for it, because they were the much bigger Navy, so you know. But...
What role was perceived for the Fleet Air Arm at that time?
Was it well, it was, again, remember we were then, and after I left DAOT, I went as Staff Aviation Officer to Flag Officer Aircraft Carriers. and that was Charles Evans again, who had been my boss at Caldera's. And we were then Comcar Strike Group 2, the second striking group Atlantic, and this was confrontation with the Soviet Union, and so our job was in these major NATO exercises was to go up there on the north of Norway to be attacking Russian installations in and around the Kola Inlet. And we had just coming into service at that time the Buccaneer. And the Buccaneer, and the Scimitar, first of all. And the Scimitar was able to carry a nuclear bomb. So you were able to simulate strikes at, like, 1,000 miles by toss-bombing this nuclear weapon. That was the major deterrent part that we had. And so the role of the Fleet Air Arm, really... was to man up the strike carriers to carry the war to the Soviet Union, and that was what all the exercises were about. And that's what we worked up to do. And of course, day and night. And then integrating with Comcast Strike Group 1, which was the American striking fleet, part of the Atlantic striking force. So it was good. I mean, but the Americans' equipment and their ability, particularly in air defence, they had no air defence capability. Had some good airplanes, but their actual organisation and ability was poor because they didn't. We had this marvellous thing, 984 CDS, which was unbelievable. And I remember my admiral saying to Comcast Strike Group 1, who was the senior, that I might as soon take my carriers into one of your formations as I would take them into a minefield, because they were so badly organised. Because they just didn't have the equipment and the organisation to do it. But it didn't really get us anywhere. I mean, there's always this great cry of, oh, well, we'll sell all this to the Americans. You'd never sell anything to the Americans like that. They're going to invent their own thing. Sorry about that. They might take some small thing, but they're not going to take anything big.
Can you explain what CDS did?
What?
What CDS did?
The carrier strike? CDS?
Yeah, you say the term CDS? What?
Did I use that term, CDS? Wait a minute. You're getting... We're talking about the radar, which was 984 CDS. That's right. Comprehensive Display System. It was a radar that was able to determine altitude as well as bearing. So, and it fed back information, which was on a computer, so you had all this stuff on a computer, all the things up, and all the targets were identified on the computer, and it was a very, very excellent comprehensive display system, much better than anything else. And you had, in the ops room, a rather chattering display, as all these things were changing, and the whole scene was displayed for you, so you had a comprehensive display of the surface picture and the air picture at the same time. Far superior to anything we'd had before, and far superior to anything the Americans had at that time. So that was where we were, and we had the usual kind of run of exercises. I remember one coming up from Gibraltar to carry out attacks on the United Kingdom, and of course it was defended by the RAF. And the RAF said, of course, I mean, you know, these carriers, we can tell exactly where they are all the time. So what we did is we had three carriers, with Victorious, Centaur, I think, and Eagle, I think. And three big tankers, and we put the tankers out, farther up. We put the three carriers inshore, silent. And the Ian Easton, the direction officer, was absolutely furious because this beautiful radar was turned off. Why was it turned off? Because it was like a bloody beacon when it was on, so we didn't have it on. So the RAF then was trying to find us, never did find us. And we finally launched a scimitar for a simulated attack on Predanek with a nuclear weapon. At 1,000 miles, and so we were able to strike the United Kingdom before the RAF had found us. And at a subsequent briefing, they said, oh, we knew exactly where you were, pointing to all the tankers. And we said, well, that. And Charles Evans left it right until the end. When the meeting was closing, he stood up and said, that was very interesting, Chief Marshal, wherever he was. However, as every naval officer here knows, you were attacking the wrong target. And it's been so... It was all part of this. There was this beginning of this battle between the RAF and the Navy, which was so damaging to both of them at the end of the day.
Was the basis of that really in the economics of the time?
Yes, I mean, I think the worry we had was that if you could say, well, oh, we can travel with these carriers at any time, not take them out whenever we want, then why have them? You know, and so we were fighting for our own existence in a way. And the RAF, in its own way, was trying to demonstrate that it really did have in our air power the ability to dominate the ocean or the land. So these exercises at that time were important. We then had, of course, at that time, the Comcast Strike Group 2, Flag Officer Aircraft Carriers, RIT did not run east of Suez. His RIT ran for the Atlantic, but not east of Suez. And when the carriers went east of Suez, they came out of the command of the Commander-in-Chief RS Fleet. So there was one famous occasion when he was allowed to go out there, fly his flag out there in Centaur, I think so. And he then, we had a kind of, it's all in my book, a fairly hilarious and rather, well, anyway, I shouldn't have done some of the things I did, but I did. But anyway, that was all in demonstrating that, you know, the fish heads really didn't know how to operate aircraft carriers. And we had two, if you remember, later on, we had both Eagle and Ark Royal out there. And that was a tremendous effort to keep those big carriers at sea out there and topped up with aircraft and maintained properly. And it was a big task. But we were able to do it, but we were coming up, although we didn't know it, towards the kind of the great debate when it was, do we really need these carriers? And of course it was Healy who came to the conclusion that we didn't. But that was to follow.
In 1959, I believe you went to 705 Squadron for helicopter conversion training.
Yes, I did. I went down there when I was on the staff of somebody the other. I thought, well, because we've got so many helicopters coming in, I better become helicopter qualified. So I went down to, it was Cold Rose again by this time, because the Naval Air Fighter School had moved to Lossiemouth. And I went to the helicopter course, yes, and enjoyed it very much.
Different type of flying again.
Yes, although different, but enjoyable, equally enjoyable, different, slightly different skills. but the point I was trying to make, apart from that, at that time there was a great kind of snobbery about fixed wing and rotary wing, and I was in a small way trying to demonstrate that, you know, that they were both equally effective, as indeed they were. And we had to come to the decision at a later stage to abandon the Gannet as an anti-submarine aircraft and go for the helicopter instead. And I know that caused a lot of kind of pain and upset to a lot of people, particularly Westerns who were building the thing. But that was a sensible way to go, as history showed that was the right decision to take.
What were the benefits of a helicopter above a fixed wing?
Because it could go into the hover and lower its ball down as a detecting device, whereas with a fixed wing you've got to lay sonar buoys. You couldn't hover and put an actual dipping sonar in the water. The helicopter had this enormous advantage. And when we came to develop the 195, which was a really super dipping sonar, then of course the helicopter was miles ahead of the Gannet and miles ahead of the Shackleton. Although there was still a role for long-range anti-submarine aircraft with sonar buoys to lay barriers and to make sure that, you know, you've got some feeling for where the submarines were coming from. But anything inside close range, inside 20 miles or so, the helicopter was far superior.
When you went down to Culross, what type of helicopter did you learn to fly?
Well, the basic helicopter then was the Hiller. Which was a little tiny helicopter. You almost make it dance. It was. I'm sure lots of people through the helicopter had the same thing. Once they done, ta dun ta dun ta dun, and make it dance around the airfield. It was. And then, not such a nice aeroplane. Unfortunately, the Wessex, the Whirlwind 1 and the Whirlwind 3. I think then they were monsters. And then the Wessex 5 eventually, which was a delight to drive. I mean, that was a twin engine aeroplane. A very good aeroplane, but the Whirlwind, I mean, how chaps cope with those as they did in the jungles of Borneo and everywhere else, I really don't know, but because they were monstrous aeroplanes.
How were they monstrous? What was the...
Well, they were basically Sikorsky aircraft that had been bastardised, if that's the right word, I think it is, by Westland, who had taken a licence to build them and then put so many British things in them that they were terribly heavy. I mean, if you had to revert to manual, if the auto control went out, I mean, the bloody stick was thrashing around the cockpit like this. I mean, it was, for me, and I'm not a particularly strong chap, and it was a disaster. So it was a pain.
Admiral, you explained to me earlier, much earlier in the tape, about how you learnt to fly, obviously, aircraft. Could you just give me some basic principles of how you fly a helicopter for a non-flyer?
Yes, I mean, the only... Well, you've got a stick which, once you're airborne, it tilts the rotors so that you can fly forward or fly sideways or fly this way, or you can actually fly backwards, although it's a bit dangerous. But and then you've got a collective lever which changes the angle of the blades so that you can, if you put full power on the aircraft and then put the angle of the blades so that they start to lift, then they'll lift you up. So you use the collective down here to raise and lower you. Right. You had a collective lever to give you lift, which caused the angle to change. Many years, not all that many years later, I went to... I inherited, as I became Director of Naval Air Warfare, Deputy Director of Naval Air Warfare, the plan for the replacement of the Wessex 3 helicopter, which had a excellent weapons system in it, the 195 sonar and radar, but an appalling endurance, and to replace it. And so I went over to America, it's a long story, but and had lunch at Sikorsky and sat next to Igor Sikorsky, who was the man, of course, who invented what was called the flapping hinge. The problem with all helicopters up to then had been, because if you're sitting still and you've got a thing going like that, that's fine. The minute you move the aircraft or the helicopter forward, then the advancing blade is going to get more lift than the retreating blade. So the helicopter just does that. And what Sikorsky invented was a thing called the flapping hinge, which meant that as the blade was going forward, its angle was reduced, and as it was coming aft, its angle was increased. So you smoothed out the lift between the advancing blade and the retarding blade, and that was the secret of it. But and so you got it airborne by increasing the angle of the blade, and then as you moved it forward, thanks to Sikorsky, you were able to keep it level, because, and then you could pull back the stick and have it climb or move around, depending on that. In the early days, before what they called hover couplers and general involvement of instrument control in the aircraft, you had to do it all by feel of the pants, as it were. And what you could easily do was overpower. In other words, if you pulled up too quickly, the blades would stall because they hadn't got to, you know. And so it was a delicate balance in the early days, particularly with a thing like the Hiller, which was why it was such a good training aircraft. There was very little power there to so that you could abuse the aircraft, as it were, very quickly, and it would show you that it was being abused. I mean, it would actually entirely could flutter to the ground if you weren't careful, because it had lost lift. So there were those things in the early days of helicopters, and those people that flew them, particularly those that flew them in the jungles, I mean, must have been extremely capable aviators, really.
And when you find the helicopter, are your feet doing anything?
Yes, you have rudders in exactly the same way as you do in a conventional aircraft. Of course, in a jet you have rudders, but you don't use them. Now, with my little aeroplane now, I have to use the rudders because it's... to get it to yaw, to get into a turn. So with the helicopter, you still have the same kind of thing. You can use the rudders will give you directional control. And remember that the directional control in a helicopter is largely controlled by that little disc that's aft, this way, going that way. So it pulls, if you've got power on that to move you one way or the other. So yes, but and as they get bigger, when I went over and flew all of them, and I flew a Chinook, for example, the biggest helicopter that we've got at the moment today, and then it flies just like an aeroplane. I mean, when I say an aeroplane, I mean like a fixed-wing aeroplane. That you can bring it on the approach and put the stick forward and put the nose down and increase the power because the throttle is on the end of the... And later on, they weren't connected at one stage, and then they connected them. So as you pull the collected lever up, so the throttle would open automatically. Whereas at the early stages, you had to do this yourself and judge it yourself. So there have been an enormous number of improvements, thank goodness, in helicopters.
When you're initially training, is it easy to get it into that kind of hover stance so that you're not overcompensating?
Yes, it is. I mean, if you are a reasonably skilled aviator and have your wits about you, it's not too difficult. And but it does... There is a lot of knack to it, as there is in so many aspects of flying. And so it's a question of getting used to it, particularly landing, to get the aeroplane to rotate so that it stops and then come back into the hover and then gently land. And as all that tends to be taking place very quickly, then you can easily get it wrong and make a heavy landing.
did you enjoy flying helicopters in the same
way?
Yes,
I did. I did enjoy flying helicopters. It was a different form of flying, but just as enjoyable. And I'm not flying it. I used to fly quite a bit when I was running British Aerospace. I would charge it to the company and get an aeroplane and fly the helicopter around. And in fact, I thought of trying to con the board into buying a helicopter once. So the trouble with being an aviator, when you want to do it, they think, oh, here goes Liger again. He wants to have a toy for himself, which in a way is partially true, not wholly true, but it's better for somebody who's not an aviator to get a helicopter than one that is a helicopter pilot or a frustrated helicopter pilot. Mm.
What was the next move, obviously, after you'd done those staff roles? What were you?
While I was still doing flag officer aircraft on the staff aviation officer, my appointment came through and I was to drive a brand new frigate called the Lowestoft, which was building up at Alexander Stevens on the Clyde. And I was to go up there. I remember talking to an awfully nice man who was the captain of Hermes and saying to him, have you got any advice for me, sir, going to drive my first ship? And his name, nice man. And he said, just be yourself, Ray, just be yourself. Don't try to be something else. If you just be yourself, you'll be a great success. And so I went up to, I did some courses, and then flew up to Glasgow and went and met the officers in the ship's company of the Lowestoft, which was then just completing building at Alexander Stevens. And I remember talking to the First Lieutenant, Alistair McIver, about it and saying, well, do you think we're getting as good a finish as we ought to? And we decided to go down, we called a tram, can you believe it, and went down the other side of the Clyde to Yarrows to see Brighton, I think, was building at Yarrows. And very kindly, the First Lieutenant of the Brighton allowed us to walk all around it. And at the end of it, we looked at each other and said, we've got a better finish than that. So by this time, I'd asked again, see the directors to complain about the finish, but I'm bound to say I didn't have much to say for myself when I got in there, particularly when I went to a boardroom which was surrounded by oil paintings of all the ships they'd built going back 150 years. So I felt rather, a small fry. So we went, we took it to see for the final sea trials and came back into Rosyth and lay off, and the Commodore commanding contract built ships, who was the chap in charge, asked me to sign for the ship. I signed for the ship. I think it was in those days about £3 million. Thank you. Fancy trying to get a frigate for that now. And I thought it was a tremendous amount of money at the time. And I took her away. And what I knew about driving a frigate, you could write on the back of a Tuppenny stamp. So we learned the hard way. But then that was a new life entirely, and I took her and did all her sea trials in and out of Portsmouth. And then we were a Chatham-based ship. I had a house in Kent, and I discovered that I was to go and drive a ship called the... I don't know, it may have been the Brighton. No, it couldn't have been. So it was a frigate building in the dockyard, because we used to build frigates in the dockyard in those days, in Plymouth. And the chap who was going to drive the ship down in Plymouth was an aviator. I'm trying to think of his name now. And he was... this ship was going to be a Chatham ship. And he lived in Devonport. And I was going to drive a Devonport ship. And I lived in Chatham, or nearby. So I rang him up one day and said, if I can swap these... And he said, well, if you think you can do it right. I said, well, I don't see why not. So I rang up the appointers, and they said, well, yes, all right, fine, we'll give you Lowestoft, and the other chap can have this other one. So that's how I came to have a Chatham ship, which was very handy for me, being, what, only 20, 30 miles away from where I lived.
A couple of questions there. You said you learnt the hard way. Again, for non-naval people, what is the role of a captain in a ship?
Driving it. I mean, basically, it very much depends on the captain, as I found, although I didn't know at the time, I mean, as far as I was concerned, it was a hands-on thing to do. I drove the ship, I took the ship away, brought her and put her alongside, took control of her in any emergency situation, or, for instance, a replenishment at sea, anything like that, the captain would be driving the ship. The navigating officer, or the pilot, as he's called, would be really running the ship from a driving point of view while you weren't doing that. But one of the things that, you see, if you are landing an aircraft, then you only have two things to worry about. You have, well, one really, and that's the wind. So you're coming down a runway, and either the wind is off the runway, it's on the runway, and you've got to compensate for the fact that the wind is either stronger or weaker, and it's on the runway, off the runway, so you've got wind. With the ship, you've got two. You've got the windage on the ship, and you've got the current affecting the ship. So there are two things affecting the ship, and attempting to bring the ship in, as I used to, as most people did, on what I used to, what I subsequently called a decaying power curve. That is to say, you were coming alongside, throttling back all the time. All the time, all these dimensions were changing, and so it was a difficult thing to do. If you look at how a little old merchantman will do it, he'll take the way off his ship, practically almost stop, then pomp, 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 he'll come ahead at a steady speed. So now he's steadied everything down. Everything is now steady, except he's got windage to worry about and he's got current to worry about. But he's not on the decaying speed curve, which means everything is changing all the time. But nobody took the trouble to explain that to me. But, I mean, I found out myself. It was amazing to me that here I was, as an aviator, being sent in command of a ship. It was really fairly basic, rudimentary training. Whereas if we were taking somebody to fly an aeroplane, we would spend hours getting it right before he did it. And yet, in a way, it was a more simple thing, landing it, than bringing a ship alongside. But, and I went off to the West Indies, we did it. Well, first of all, we did a workup at Portland, and in my rash way, I did several things that I shouldn't have done. But we went there a day early. Nobody ever but heard of that, going for a workup at there. I went a day early and did some stern to the wall on the mole at Portland, so that I could practice that. And I I failed my ship's company, and I can you believe the overconfidence of LIGO at times is quite extraordinary. And I said to them, I'm going to give the workup team here, Flag Officer Sea Training, a week to show us that he can work this ship up. And at the end of that, we'll start working them up. Well, you know, and it was regarded in those days as really a hellhole to go through. Anyway, we succeeded, but I made one fundamental mistake, because I was off shore one night for dinner out in Portland or somewhere. And before I went, I said to the officer of the day, where's the first lieutenant? He said, oh, he's turned in, sir. I said, what's the matter with him? He said, well, he's not very well. So I went down, and he was not only not very well, he was very ill with what looked to me like pleurisy. And I said, right, to the officer of the day, get the doctor, the duty doctor, in to look at him. Oh, no, I said, I'm fine, I'm going to be fine. I said, no, Alice, you're not going to be fine, you're not fine.